We look back at 2019. Curtis Hill and a disciplinary complaint, Pete Buttigieg's meteoric rise, plus Governor Holcomb, President Trump, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending December 27th, 2019.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, we look back at Curtis Hill in 2019. Four women say Curtis Hill groped them at a party in 2018. Those allegations prompted the State Disciplinary Commission to file a complaint against Hill early this year. Former Indiana Supreme Court Justice Myra Selby presided over a four-day hearing on that complaint in October. And in December, the Disciplinary Commission asked Selby to suspend Hill's law license for 2 years. That would preclude him from remaining as Attorney General. There's no timetable for Selby's decision. Despite all of that, did Curtis Hill escape 2019 largely unscathed? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanes, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, if you're Curtis Hill, and you're not, but if you were Curtis Hill,
thank the Lord,
are you still feeling pretty good about how 2019 went for you?
Well, you know, he takes his pages out of Donald Trump's playbook, so I'm sure he thinks as long as he has the office, which he still has, despite even Nikki's story about how he sets up these satellites and charges all kinds of money for his transportation to and from the State House and all the other things he's done, like trying to kick 400,000 Hoosiers out of Medicaid coverage. All of those things, I think he thinks that he's above the law and he's got the office and he's, you know, he's Curtis Hill and the rules don't apply to him.
Do you think Curtis Hill should feel good about how 2019 went?
I don't know how you get to the end of the year and just think, if you're Curtis Hill, what a year. Just crushed it all year long. I'm just crushing it. Look, there's so many layers to this now. There's the original, why is he at a bar at 2 in the morning with a bunch of lobbyists being inappropriate with women, which he started denying completely. He started denying he even drank that night, which we all know now to be true, but it was just the same strategy, which was just deny, and just keep moving forward and
kind of
unabashedly so, right?
Doesn't it sound like Donald Trump?
We're not playing your game, Ann. It's my turn for a minute. But no, I think and now we have of course Nikki's well done article about his spending practices in office, which should really offend Republicans, you would think, especially base Republicans. And then the findings of what we're hearing now about state time being used to go after the victims in this, to go after other people who aren't his political allies and create these dossiers and all this just crazy stuff.
Yes, the Holcomb cronies.
I don't know of which I think I'm a part. I'd like to read my own dossier.
Maybe not.
End of 2019, and the bad news is we've got to deal with it for at least 6 more months and whatever that looks like. You know, if the Disciplinary Commission comes in, or the Supreme Court now comes in and determines that his law license is suspended. Well, that's not a clean argument either, whether a suspended license forces an automatic
the length of that suspension.
They have to revoke the license.
Vacates office. You have a legislature that's going to be in session potentially during that period and have the opportunity to clarify that law, maybe, or impeach him if they think they've got cover to do so. So, no, 2019 was a terrible year for any politician who's in the same situation.
You know, I'm intrigued by that comparison between Curtis Hill and Donald Trump, because on one level, there is a lot of similarity there. They both decided that,
thank you, John,
that we're just going to, you know, damn what everybody else says. We're just going to trudge on. We're going to just deny. But there is a difference. And that is, there's no chorus standing behind him when he's in the pulpit. Now, Donald Trump has how many members in the House and Senate combined, Republicans, who seem to speak in mass and
in unison,
with very few exceptions, maybe the occasional.
The Republicans didn't do anything to him, to Curtis Hill here either when
Well, I'm not sure. Most everybody has called for his
resignation, but they could have impeached him and they didn't do it.
Well, but I do think this. I've said this before. I think this will, Eric Holcomb this will be a real, we always talk about how effective he is behind the scenes. And I think he is effective behind the scenes.
Well, you do. I don't.
I know you don't. You don't think much about him. But I think he has proven an ability to stave off problems by addressing them before they blow up in his face. The test will be, can he make sure that the outcome from the convention is something to his liking and to the liking of other Republicans?
And the answer
is no, he can't. Well, I'd be eager to see. I don't know if he can or can't.
Is that really... So is that really what's going to sort of determine how 2020 goes for Curtis Hill, is what Eric Holcomb and state party leaders do behind the scenes?
Well, it'll be a big factor. I spoke to the governor yesterday and asked him directly, you know, how active are you going to be about making sure that Curtis Hill is not the Republican nominee? And he basically said it's too early. He wants to let this legal process, you know, play out. But he is hoping that there's some sort of resolution, you know, so that voters have that information before we get to the convention. But, I mean, at some point, this wait and see is not going to be enough.
Yeah, especially because that timeline is really uncertain.
Yeah.
Both from Selby's decision and then eventually the Supreme Court's
decision. The convention is not uncertain. It's 7 months from now. The field's
right.
Not set. We're
but
2 months
away. Let me ask this question, and I'm actually interested in your answer on it.
As opposed to the others.
No.
These courtesy answers, the courtesy interesting things.
I'm interested... I just asked the question about what Eric Holcomb needs to do behind the scenes to try and make sure that Curtis Hill doesn't win the renomination at the Republican convention. Does some of that have to be not behind the scenes? Does he have to come out more publicly maybe not now, but as we get closer to it and say, this is exactly what I want?
Well, as publicly as you do in a convention room with 1,500 people in it that you're trying to 751 of which you're trying to sway your direction. So we don't know what that looks like right now. We don't know who's going to run. We don't know where the votes are. What we do know is party leaders, and I'm on state committee, and we have a chairman that's clearly fully supports the governor and has called for Curtis to resign, and has been very clear in state committee meetings and with party leaders that this does in fact put the seat at risk in November if we do renominate him, and there's a reason for that. So I think there's going to be a lot of activity behind the scenes with those electors in that convention. Now, whether or not you want the governor to get up on, you know, and talk to 6 million Hoosiers about it, it doesn't really matter in June of 2020.
Yeah, but, you know, there's a lot of room there with those 751. And if you wait to the convention to come forward and try to break arms...
We don't know who they are, to be fair. We don't even know who they are yet.
That's true.
Yeah, you know, but you know a number of them because they go every year.
Sure.
The same people run every year. And he ought to be on the phone with them now saying, don't pledge your support to Curtis Hill. And if he isn't doing that, the convention's going to be too late.
And if, in fact, it is too late, and in fact somehow Curtis Hill is renominated, I want to see the group photograph that obligatory where everybody joins hands and sort of raises.
Yeah. I don't think they're going to get that.
Well, you better not.
There may be some cardboard cutouts being trotted out to photoshopping.
We had precedent for that too,
haven't we? Right, well, likely no other Hoosier political figure had a bigger 2019 than South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg. The Northern Indiana Democrat announced earlier in the year he was forming an exploratory committee for a presidential run, and after attracting attention for a CNN town hall in March, he made his bid official in April. Since then, the 37-year-old has steadily risen in the polls, climbing into the top tier of candidates late in the year, particularly in the first two presidential contests, Iowa and New Hampshire. That's despite definite bumps along the way, including, notably, a shooting in South Bend in which a white police officer killed an African-American man. That incident shone a spotlight on problems Buttigieg faces with minority voters. So, Mike O'Brien, despite those issues I just kind of referenced, has Buttigieg had about the best 2019 he could have had?
Yeah, I mean, credit where credit's due, right? I mean, he's the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, and he went from, I think he's 37 years old. I mean, that in and of itself,
yeah,
his
just
age
being 37
and his position
year old.
And being on that in that winnowing field and that debate stage is a lot. He's done what you need to do at this part of the process. He's raised a record amount of money. He's raising more money than a former vice president, a guy who's their front runner, who's been in the U.S. Senate for 4 decades. So, yeah, I mean, that all line, you got to give him credit. I mean, there is not a well-worn path from mayor of a mid-sized city in the Midwest who's 37 years old and openly gay to become one of the party's front runners for the major party nomination.
When you listen to it put exactly that way, Are you surprised that he's where he is
right
now?
Oh, yeah, I am. I mean, when I talked to him at the beginning of the year about this, I said, well, you know, I'll be happy to be with you as long as you're in this. But, you know, I never expected. Well, seriously.
No. That's the only way Ann Delaney can put an endorsement. I'm with you till you fail, which is going
to
happen.
I didn't expect him to fail, but I certainly didn't expect him to be able to project himself into the conversation with such success as quickly as he has done. And I think any Hoosier looking at this, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, ought to be proud of the image that he is presenting on the national stage for the state of Indiana. This is, again, a small, relatively small city in a small Midwestern state, and yet we have an articulate, intelligent, informed, very classy candidate coming from here that does all Hoosiers proud, I think. And I don't think he could have had a better year, and he's even weathered the bumps. Yeah. As well as you can.
We talked throughout this whole process this year with Pete Buttigieg about, especially early on, it was about, you know, what is he really jockeying for? Is it a cabinet position?
Right,
is it a vice president?
Everybody made the assumption.
Right, but everybody figured that's where this ended up. It's president or bust, right?
Well, no, I mean, obviously, I still think it's more likely that he's not the nominee than is, though I'm very open with the fact that he's gotten further than I think any of us here could have thought.
Yeah.
But, you know, he does have to think about what he's going to do with all this newfound clout, you know, when and if he's not the nominee. And how can he put that best to work for Indiana, whether that means a Senate run or a governor run? I mean, these are things he needs to be kind of considering.
Is his path, though, is his path, given what Indiana looks like and what races are open in the next few years, is his political future outside of Indiana?
It may well be. And we shouldn't just say that he has to run for office in Indiana to continue to maintain the momentum. It may well be that he's a commentator. I mean, it might be something entirely out of the realm of elective politics. Maybe more of who knows? There are any number of options that would keep him in the limelight. But I can't help but chuckle. A few years back, when he had the temerity to run for national party chair of the Democratic National Committee that Tom Perez ended up winning. And we had a conversation, if I'm not mistaken, like, what is he going for? Because clearly he's not going to be party chair. So he must be angling for something else. How precocious of this unheard of guy, you know, whose name nobody could pronounce to go after that. Well, guess what? I guess his strategy of I'm going to aim everything
really
I go
high.
After, I'm going to aim high, seems to be paying dividends so far.
And, you know, there's a precedent for vice presidents from Indiana as well.
I've heard that. There's a guy right now, in fact, I think.
I know. And Pete Buttigieg would be so much better.
Well, heading into re-election year in 2020, Governor Eric Holcomb's approval ratings were strong and steady throughout 2019. Approval north of 50%, with a small number of Hoosiers disapproving and many, quite frankly, not expressing an opinion. Still, there have been a few ethics issues that marked the year for the Holcomb administration. There were questions about a private flight Holcomb took to a conference chartered by casino magnate Rod Radcliffe in the midst of a major gaming debate. Mid-year, DCS Deputy Director Todd Meyer abruptly resigned with no explanation until it was revealed in the press he acted inappropriately with a young intern. And late in the year, Reveal published a story alleging that the Holcomb administration officials sought to, quote, manipulate an investigation into a worker death at an Amazon warehouse seeking to absolve the company of any involvement. So, Nikki Kelly, has Eric Holcomb had a good year?
I think so, because let's be honest, his polling has been good, as you mentioned, and so those things that you mentioned there haven't resonated with the general public. So what's resonating more is, you know, improved roads or, you know, he's looking at broadband and things like that. So I think he's had a pretty good year, an occasional speed bump, but that's to be expected, I think.
Eric Holcomb's strategy from the outset when he suddenly became the gubernatorial candidate in 2016 was good government at great taxpayer cost. He's really hasn't wavered from that kind of core message. Is it working?
I think that's what I sort of suggested from the outset, not that anybody was listening, but I think because of reform fatigue, because so many different, we have enough drama elsewhere in elective politics, certainly.
I have no idea what you could possibly be referencing.
There's some township, town council races I was going to tell you about.
Sure.
But when you look at him, he is, I think it's Hoosiers generally can agree that we want our tax dollars spent properly and effectively and get the biggest bang for the buck possible. And I don't think it's any accident that, unlike some of his counterparts around the country, who every time Donald Trump does something that is puts him, well, everything he does puts him in the limelight, but there's not this tendency for him to go call a news conference and say, I stand behind Donald Trump. I mean, you don't see him attached. So it's not as if people who are going to, who are, their sole purpose in life now is to see Donald Trump defeated at the polls, are not really, don't have Eric Holcomb in their sights. You can, you know, they can say, here's a guy who is pragmatic. I don't know if anybody's middle of the road anymore in our society, but I mean, he is, he's focusing on economic issues. And as long as the economy is doing as well as it has, and we've seen not only the job numbers, but people's perception of the economy in some of the poll numbers, which is equally important, he's golden on both counts.
Let me ask this. There's been a lot of talk on this show and elsewhere about that the unusual nature of that 2016 campaign, where Eric Holcomb, in part because of a boost from Donald Trump, became governor, based not being able to build a lot of name ID in that first campaign. So he's had now 3 years to do that. Has Eric Holcomb built a strong enough brand as he heads into re-election?
No, I don't think he's had the time to, because for the reason you just described, and that's not a fault of his. It's a byproduct of the environment being as noisy as it is at the top, which we've never really seen before. I mean, the intensity with which the national political noise and how it infiltrates down to other offices is really hard to break through. And he didn't have what most governors have, which is they were lieutenant governor for 8 years, or they ran for 2.5 years for the office, or you know, were a U.S. senator first, or a member of Congress first, or what, you know, whatever the resume leading up to that, the political resume that lends itself to that. You know, Mike Braun's going to have the same problem. He's a businessman, right? I mean, he's a really successful businessman.
Yeah.
Now he's in the U.S. Senate. He's going to need. It's not that the name ID is important, but a focus on the durability of your of what people believe about you. And I think what Eric Holcomb has proven in 3 years, and will be able to message in a fourth year, concurrent with a campaign, is that he's focused on things that people want state government to do, that the things that they care about, that they're not controversial, and they don't have to, you know, if our experience in the last 20 years tells us anything about Frank O'Bannon, Joe Kernan, Mitch Daniels, Mike Pence, and Eric Holcomb, certainly not to disparage Governor Mike Pence, but when you focus on things that, and the legislature was partly blamed for this too, with the biggest example ever of RFRA, when you focus so far outside of like the pragmatism of most Hoosiers, you're going to pay a consequence for that. Now, of course, the consequence for Governor Mike Pence was became vice president.
Yeah, that's a pretty good consequence.
But I think Governor Holcomb is clearly focused on things that most Hoosiers care about. He actually genuinely does care about things that most Hoosiers care about. He's going to get rewarded next year.
I think that comes off that way too. But did Eric Holcomb have a good year?
I think he had a relatively good year because, frankly, he didn't do much of anything. I think those bumps in the road, the bumps in the road that you mentioned, I don't think necessarily stick. I think the big serious mistake he made was not being there when the teachers came to the State House. I think that was a serious error in judgment, as well as kicking the teacher increase down the road. I think that's going to come back in a much more dramatic way to haunt him in the reelection campaign, because there are 60,000 teachers out there in Indiana, and they know when you can argue what the standard of living. You can argue all you want, but we are paying them less than Kentucky. Okay, we are, and those chickens are going to come home to roost, and he's going to pay a price for that.
I did want to say, you talked about the noise that permeates from the national level. Standing in the governor's office in his lobby, waiting to interview him earlier this week, his receptionist picks up the phone. You know, governor's office. A few seconds later, I hear the receptionist say, "Well, no, you need to call a congressman or a senator. The governor doesn't have anything to do with impeachment." So, all right. Well, 2019 was a tumultuous one, let's call it, for President Trump and Vice President Pence. The year began with a prolonged government shutdown. The president regularly feuded with his intelligence officials, culminating in the departure of Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats, a former Hoosier senator. The long-awaited Mueller report dropped, which did not explicitly conclude that Trump committed any crimes, but did outline potential obstruction of justice. And finally, as the year wrapped up, President Trump became the third president in history to be impeached. John Schwanes, was the third year of the Trump administration the most chaotic?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's empirical data. We can prove that it is chaotic. Now, that's one question. The other question is that good for him or bad for him? He has shown time and again that he thrives on the chaos. He thrives on the uproar. Sometimes one would argue he has in the past created chaos. And we saw this during the Mueller, you know, at various times when there could have been issues that could have been troublesome, he was very skilled at bringing up some tangential issue that people who weren't following it closely might have said, boy, here's another uproar he found himself in the middle of. Well, he probably was the one who was there with the matchbox trying to light that uproar to get people focusing on it. I mean, when you send out 123, I think that might have been the record for tweets the other day. I don't even know. I mean, do they still have the character limit? Because otherwise, you
they
can
do.
Still,
but it's a lot higher.
That's Dostoevsky.
He's not governing.
Well, Dostoevsky.
John kind of asked the question that I was going to ask you, Nikki, which is: so let's be it stipulated, it was the most chaotic year of the Trump administration.
Absolutely.
Yet. Does that hurt him?
No, his supporters are all in, and they are, you know, nothing he does seems to matter to them at all, as long as he's saying. I mean, I think what they most like is that he's not following the sort of conventional, polite rules or what they would consider to be politically correct. And they like that. They like him just being freewheeling, you know, Donald Trump. I will say one thing. He really likes to make history, and he is now one of three. So
he's making it.
And the largest margin
he was ever
impeached by. So that's a win for him.
he has his supporters. That's true. But the problem is with independents. Because you hear in even moderate Republicans who say it's enough. I mean, he's destroyed our reputation nationally. He argues that there is no such thing as climate change and we don't have to take any steps to deal with it. He tries to undermine our democracy. He encourages the Russians to involve themselves in our elections. There are so many. And he uses that office to make himself wealthy, even wealthier than he is. So you put all of those things together, and I think there's a fatigue out there among people who look at this, who are not diehard supporters who would, you know, any dictator would do as long as he's strong. You're going to have problems because his conduct is so bad.
Anne just brought up something interesting to me, which is the idea of fatigue. Is there going to be a Trump fatigue that we see at the polls next year where it's people who just say, enough? That not even necessarily voting for somebody else or even
not
voting
knowing.
Against. It's just, I'm done.
Yeah, I think you see the Trump campaign already leaning into that by embracing kind of, look, we've done a lot of things you like.
Yeah.
You may not like the style, but I'm not going to apologize for it to try to maybe preempt some of that. Because I think that is real in a close election with moderate voters. Now, unless Democrats nominate a kook. Then they're like, look, I'm not doing Medicare for All, so I guess I'm just signing up for another tour here.
All right. Well, as you look back at 2019, who is your biggest winner in the Hoosier political scene? And we will start with you, Anne Delaney. Who's your biggest winner?
I think you have to give it to Pete Buttigieg. There's no question. No question. Hands down.
Mike? Biggest winner of 2019.
Biggest winner of 2019. I'll go with Pete Buttigieg, too. Why not? I mean, in Indiana, it's hard to pick, like, an Indiana Democrat that'd be the biggest winner because there's so few of them, but we'll go with Pete Buttigieg.
Alert, folks, this might be history in the making. Everybody agrees. I think that's exactly right. Pete Buttigieg, for all the reasons that have been mentioned.
It's obviously Pete Buttigieg. Now, just for discussion's sake, I will throw out Vice President Mike Pence because, you know, he's gotten through the most chaotic year with the president relatively unscathed, and he's managed to sort of tailor his focus and just do his job.
Yeah. Don't disagree with us, by the way.
No, I was going to pick
okay.
Just because, I mean, as we discussed, who would have thought that Pete Buttigieg is where he is? Now, for the biggest loser of the Hoosier political scene of 2019, Mike, we'll start with you on this one.
There's not a lot of glaring downsides in Indiana politics this year, right? Yeah. With the exception of Curtis Hill, and I understand this may be the first time ever that the Republican on this show picked the biggest winner as a Democrat and the biggest loser as a Republican. But
well, we're making history of all kinds this year.
Moving, I'll
pick all the Republicans that push for school reform. Because we have had so many problems with that, from virtual schools on down to the charters who have their things, their licenses pulled, and all the money we've spent on that, and all the time we didn't put the money we should have put in 93% of the students.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to see that it's anyone but Curtis Hill. I mean, to have a statewide office holder going through what he's been publicly it's been embarrassing for the state, and it should be embarrassing for him.
I would agree with that. And then aside from that, I would just say the notion of compromise and collaboration. It's not as bad, certainly, at the state level. We still seem to be able to get it done here. But let's hope it doesn't turn into, Washington doesn't seep into Indianapolis in terms of that kind of polarization.
Finally, as we approach 2020 and a new decade, as I asked last year, what do you think Indiana's New Year's resolution should be? Quickly, Nikki Kelly.
I mean, sometimes I would think it should be, you know, try something bold, but I have a feeling that because it's the big election year, it'll be more like do no harm.
Do no harm. That's not bad.
It's been the motto for the Republican administration
let's
forever.
Let's pay attention. Bill Morrow and Morrow, they started Indiana Citizen, which was a good thing that came out of the 2019 calendar year. Let's hope that that momentum that that creates can take us someplace in terms of engagement and awareness on the part of the electorate.
Well, that is Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR. Or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Hope you had a great holiday, a happy Hanukkah, and join us next time because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.